I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, huh?
There's always a pecking order. Little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken, so to speak.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just go to the website bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you will see the link to become a Patreon donor yourself. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we are going to have part two of our interview with Rick Wayne. Rick was probably the greatest writer ever in the bodybuilding industry. He wrote for Joe Weider's Muscle Builder magazine back in the day, and then he also wrote for Flex magazine. And Rick was an awesome bodybuilder himself. His incredible condition, if you ever see earlier pictures of Rick, was just unbelievable. And Rick went on to win the 1967 IFBB Mr. World contest, but he also did very well in a lot of other competitions, and he probably should have had a couple more victories. But regardless, Rick went on to become a writer, and he wrote the books The Body Men. He also wrote a great book called Muscle Wars. If you haven't checked that out, you got to try to get a hold of that. And he wrote the Three More Reps book, of which there were three of them in the late 70s, early 80s. So check out Rick's writing on eBay or Amazon or wherever you can check it out. But Rick was a fantastic writer. He's got a lot of experience in the game. And I have been trying to get Rick on the show for 3 years. So I'm very, very honored and happy that we were able to talk to the great Rick Wayne. And you guys are really going to love part two of our interview here today. And last week's episode of part one of our interview with Rick was very, very well received. It seems like every year, this is now the fifth year I've been doing the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and every year I come up with one really knock them out of the park interviews. And Rick was definitely the interview this year for the one that really struck with the fans, and people really got excited and really responded to it. So we got a lot of emails. Usually I don't get any emails. I got several emails this week from you guys. If anybody's ever interested in emailing me, you can do it at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I also put it up on YouTube. So if you're on YouTube and you want to check out the video of our interview, just go to my page, John Hansen, and you will see the Rick Wayne interview part one that is up there. And I put a lot of old pictures. I really went into the archives of my magazines, the old Muscle Builder magazines, and I got some really, really great pictures. So you guys will have to check that out. So before we start our interview, I do want to go over some of these emails just to acknowledge them. I got some really good ones on the Facebook one, so I'm going to do that in a second. When we get done with our interview with Rick, I am going to read one of his most popular articles ever. And this comes from the August, I think it was the 1981 issue of Muscle and Fitness. So this is by the time Muscle Builder had changed over to Muscle and Fitness. So this was the August 1981 issue. Not that long, really, right after the 1980 Mr. Olympia, which was very controversial. And this was about Arnold. And Rick is going to talk a lot about Arnold in this upcoming interview we're going to listen to in part two. But the name of this article is Arnold, Saint or Devil? And it's written by Rick Wayne. So this was a very controversial article. Arnold was kind of pissed off at it. As Rick said in our interview, he thought Rick focused more on the devil side of Arnold than the saint. So it's a long article, but you guys are going to love it if you love Rick's writing. So I will read that as soon as our interview with Rick is over. Let me get to some of these emails. This guy says, hello, Mr. Hansen. My name is Martin Dodd from Dubbo, Australia. I'm into bodybuilding too. I've been doing it since 1996. I've been watching your workouts on YouTube. Thank you. I look up to you, sir. You're a great bodybuilder. All right. Thank you, Martin, all the way from Australia. This one says, great interview with Rick Wayne. I just finished part one. Stories I've never heard before. Thanks, John, for the hard work. We should all refer to you as Dr. Hansen. You have a PhD in bodybuilding, a true bodybuilder historian. Fred Tomasek. Thank you, Fred. This one says, oh, my God, John, I hope you're well. You answered my prayers with Rick Wayne. Wow. Oh, my God. Thank you. Great. We need a part two. Lee. All right, Lee, we got part two today. We'll have part three next week. John Hartman said, "Hey, John, just a quick note. Congratulations on getting the interview." Someone says, "Hello, John. Great interview with Rick Wayne. I can't wait for the next segment to drop. Rick was talking about an article he wrote in which he described the real workouts of the top guys. That would be a fantastic article to get a hold of. Rick is such a great interview. It's a shame he does not want to do more interviews. Regards, Jim Kerr." Jim, if you heard that interview, Rick said that Joe Weider would not put that article up because he wanted to promote the Weider principles. So that article never made print, unfortunately. This one says, "Hey, John, what an amazing interview with Rick Wayne. I remember he was my favorite writer back in the day. I pray that in part two, he will give his perspective from now on his opinion of the 1980 and 1980 Mr. Olympia contest. Your loyal viewer and friend, Kevin Hickling from Vancouver, Canada." Thank you, Kevin. And this one says, "Hi, John. Wow, you did it. You got Rick Wayne to come on your podcast. Great job. In my opinion, you get great guests to come on your podcast due to your honesty. Your honesty shines through on your podcast, and I think guests and potential guests clearly see that and appreciate it. And as a result, they want to be on your podcast. Keep up the great work. We all appreciate your dedication to the history of bodybuilding. Also, about supersetting and your MP6 program in your book, thank you for the clarifications about how you do 1 week of supersetting between the third and fourth week of the power cycle. I'm in my power cycle right now, and I just started supersetting as you outlined. So far, so good. Doing 3 sets with 10 reps as your recommendation. Anyway, thanks as always for your MP6 book and program outlined in your book. It's been a tremendous program to follow. The focused and steady progression of your program has been wonderful to follow each week and month. And again, wow, you got Ricky Wayne on the podcast. It's your honesty shining through, John. Take care, John. Well done, Dan." All right. Thank you, Dan. This one says, "Hi, John. I just want to extend my thoughts on your recent squat video you filmed at Powerhouse Gym in which you thrusted through 11 reps with a heavy weight. Today, I also managed to grind out an exceptional 11 reps with a weight I'd consider heavy for myself because I was solely motivated by your recent efforts in that squat video in which you execute your reps like a piston going up and down. I'm thoroughly enjoying these videos from Powerhouse Gym, John. Keep up the noble efforts. Similar to Tom Cruise, you're an exceptional 60-year-old. Loyal regards, Peter from Victoria, Australia." All right. Thank you, Peter. I'm glad my video inspired you. All right. Now, I also put on my Facebook page about the Rick interview, and I got a lot of attention for it. Sean Ray said, "Good stuff." Nicholas Daver said, "A bodybuilder and a writer of legendary status, to say the least. This will be exciting." Rick Valente said, "Rick is a great bodybuilder and a very talented man. He did all kinds of things for bodybuilding. Rick got me my first flex cover back in the early 1980s. I'll always respect him and be grateful for him." Matt Collison said, "Well done, John. I'm really looking forward to this one." Alo Pandaya said, "I was so looking forward to this, John. Thank you for making it happen. When Rick became a member of my Facebook group and frequently started commenting with his anecdotes, it was a wonderful moment for me personally." Chris Rolfs said, "Great. I still remember reading his Mr. Olympia recaps from the late 70s and very early 80s, especially the 80 recap. I can't wait to listen to this interview." Wayne Craig said, "A man out of time, way ahead of things, and his brilliance was overlooked, in my opinion." Gary Bartlett, the photographer from Canada, said, "Congratulations, John. I know how hard you worked to get Rick on. Finally, we can hear from a legend himself, and it was well worth the wait." Joe Rourke, the historian. Joe was the historian way before I was. He said, "The energy in Rick's voice conceals his age. His stories are exuberant. Remember the Walter Cronkite TV show, You Are There? Rick was there at the start. Someone told me that Rick carved his initials into the hull of the Mayflower of Muscle." And Bill Levesque said, "I read everything that Rick Wayne wrote, as I knew even back then that it was the real deal and not some ghostwriter articles. I have tremendous respect for Rick, both as a writer and an outstanding bodybuilder. Arms and shoulders above the rest, I read many years ago, and it was a fantastic and usable body of information." And Rick responded to Joe Rourke, and he said, "A metaphor most flattering. I thank you, kind sir." And then Rick himself commented on my page here, and he said, "What a pleasure it was listening as you read that muscle builder article that heralded in the era of Arnold Schwarzenegger." Yeah, last week on the show, I read an article Rick wrote about the 1970 Mr. Olympia and the 1970 Mr. World that Rick was competing in, and it was all held on the same night. He said, how could I have known when I wrote that I was effectively opening the door to the unimagined? Not even Arnold could have guessed what lay ahead. Great reading, as only a committed fan could have read that lengthy piece. Richard Baldwin said, I've been after Rick to do this interview with John for years. I knew he wouldn't regret it because John knows bodybuilding history and prepares for interviews so that he can extract even more of the best stories of the golden age from those who actually lived it. Another great interview, John, and I anxiously await part two as you bring out these great stories from my hero, Rick Wayne. Marty Varanikar, great bodybuilder from the 80s, said, great physique, a Sean Ray type of physique. Frank Capolupo from Chicago said, great, I wonder if Rock knew Jesse Rock Stonewall. And Rick replied, and he said, Rock Stonewall was among the very first impressive bodybuilders I got to know when I moved to New York from England. Dan Burt said, what a great interview. Thank you, John. And such a fascinating interviewee. Rick Wayne was such an influence on me in those formative teenage years. His writing opened up a world to me far beyond bodybuilding. We all await part two with bated breath. Don Adams said, outstanding writer and bodybuilder. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. This was probably my favorite one out of all of them. Jeff Preston, who has been going through some hard times, he had some heart problems, I believe, and he was just recently in the hospital. But I've known Jeff probably 20 years. The old Iron Age website that was run by Sean Perrine, where I got to meet Jeff and some other great guys, Peter McGough and Sean Perrine, and a lot of great guys that I still see on Facebook. But that was a great website back in the day. Anyways, Jeff wrote a really, really good comment here. He said, it's been hard the past few years watching the champions of the era that inspired us all pass. As they die, a little piece of all of us dies too. Saying goodbye to Dave Draper hit me especially hard and deep. He was the heart and soul of bodybuilding. Still is and always will be. And then Bill Pearl recently, bodybuilding royalty of the highest order. The friendship of Dick Tyler I treasure. There was a childlike excitement in his voice when he told us his tales of Iron Men and wooden ships. Dementia has robbed us of his voice. To hear Rick Wayne, sorry, the tears are flowing, once again has brought life back to the times that seem ancient now, as if they are happening all over again. That same Dick Tyler excitement I hear in his voice, it's the same enthusiasm that brought us all to those old plastic-covered concrete plates with dreams of 2 inches on our arms, 3 inches on our chest, and 4 inches off our waist, the first month with the Weider system. Rick has brought the magic back, and this is only part one. As important as his words were back in the day, his voice is more important now. John, of all the shows you've done, this is the one that knocked the cover off the ball. Congrats, my friend. That was a great comment. Thank you so much, Jeff, for that one. Howard Christian said, I go back to the mid-60s, and I love John's interview with Rick. Looking forward to parts 2 and 3. I'm so sorry to hear about Dick. I loved his articles in Muscle Builder back in the day. His West Coast bodybuilding scene is a gem. Les Spenlove, who competed back in the Navi Universe back in the 60s, said, I was very fortunate to experience the golden era time of 1966 in London and to share workouts and friendships with Rick, Wilford Sylvester, and Roy Callender at Bill Stevens' Stratford Gym. Those days were some of the happiest times of my life. Thanks for the sweet memories, Rick. As Joe Rourke commented on the energy that is still present in Rick's voice, I can tell you that he sounds the same today as he did 56 years ago. You can still hear in his voice the youthful excitement of a champion who truly maintains his lifelong love for bodybuilding. P. Fancher said, fantastic interview. I could listen to him tell his stories all day. Corey Everson came on and made a comment, and she says, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this interview. Even though I thought I knew so much about my friend, I learned so much more. What an incredible man Rick Wayne is. He has so many different talents. It is truly unbelievable. I can't wait to hear more. I miss him so much. And then Willie Lambert responded. He said, yes, I agree. He compliments John for his studied knowledge, which adds further the idea that Rick Wayne can speak about the 1960s bodybuilding. That was also a wealth of historical reference. The Merchant of Venom, as he was characterized. I remember the late Kay Baxter telling me in Toronto, Rick enjoyed my writing. I called him a black cocky Cosell type in a letter to the editor of Flex. I enjoyed his writing as we all did, opinionated and thought-provoking. It gave us an additional desired element to cause interest and intrigue. As a teen and an early 20s bodybuilder, I counted the weeks until next on the racks at our variety stores when we would have the following month's edition. When I converse with younger bodybuilders today, I gently tell them how wondrous it was an era, how helpful a promotion it was. Along with guest posing and seminars, those were the rage, as each champion bodybuilder often had courses and t-shirts with their personal emblem. This younger generation missed all of this. Instagram, sure, they hold their cell phone on the gym floor, and between sets, they check their likes and send messages. I just shut up. They can't hear you anyway with the earbuds pushed in their ears. A different age. Better? I don't like sounding like a grumpster, but even Arnold in the last year has called this event bullshit. Sometimes I kid with a few younger guys and I tell them, you must know how Arnold Schwarzenegger and Dorian Yates acquired their physique development, don't you? And they stare blankly. I say, oh, by texting, of course. So funny, but still a blank stare. Crazy life if you live long enough. Casey Kucharik, another great bodybuilder from the 80s, said, great interview. I enjoyed listening. Lee Haney, 8-time Mr. Olympia, came on and said, this was one of the greatest interviews ever. Rick Wayne is a legendary icon and a classic bodybuilding historian. He also said, thanks, John, for bringing this to those of us who admire real bodybuilding history. And Rick commented and he said, hey, Lee, thanks a lot. Much appreciated. This endorsement from one of bodybuilding's all-time true gentlemen. All right. Wow. Really some fantastic comments. So thanks to everybody that made those comments and listened to the show. Like I said, I always put postings up on Facebook of my recent interviews, but this one really got a lot of attention. So everybody was waiting, obviously, for Rick Wayne to talk to us on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and we're so happy that he finally did it. All right, guys, without any further ado, let me bring you part two of our interview with the great Rick Wayne. Here we go. I remember the 69 Olympia, too, when Arnold and Sergio were going back and forth. You were sitting right there, and you heard all the back and forth between them. You're like, hey, Monster, are you in shape this year? You know, and, but oh, you know, baby, what do you see what I got?
But you know what? You know what's funny, though? I sit at home, and I read all these reports, and they're all made-up stuff or little stories exaggerated because none of these people was there.
Right, right.
So I get a kick out of reading those stories, and it tells you how history – you can't really trust history one book.
Yeah.
You know, because people who don't know any better would not have checked necessarily what I wrote, and I was there.
Yeah, yeah.
But these guys write convincingly, and they think so and so. Like the stories about Sergio. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember somebody asking me once who I thought was the greater champ, who I thought was the better bodybuilder. Sergio or Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, depends. He said, depends on what? I said, well, Sergio had by far the greater physique.
Yeah.
But Arnold was by far the greater champion.
Yeah.
It's like that famous episode in Germany, was it in Munich, when everybody thought Sergio should have won.
Right, 72.
And Arnold. That's good. 72. And I remember Arnold interviewing Arnold in the office, you know, and putting him, because Arnold, it's so ironic. Arnold always felt I had a particular thing for Sergio.
Mm-hmm.
And Sergio, on the other hand, figured I was Arnold's buddy from Europe. So I was always in between the camp. And what Arnold said to me was, I think Arnold knew Sergio. Arnold respected Sergio. He was in awe of Sergio. And he went out of his way to be good to Sergio. But that's not what the record suggests. The record suggests that Arnold and Sergio were at their throats. Sergio had a problem with Arnold.
Mm.
I can understand why. I think to this day, that episode of the Mr. World in Columbus, Ohio, when Lorimer paid for those guys a special aircraft to take them in. That was a setup, and Sergio walked into it.
Yeah, yeah.
So after losing to Arnold, this a week later or a few days later, he appears against Arnold, and you expect to beat him?
Yeah.
He walked into that. He all the problems he had with Joe Weider and with Dan Lurie. How can you choose Dan Lurie against Joe Weider? Now, the thing is, was Joe racist? How the hell can be Joe racist? And I was almost umbilically tied to Joe Weider. I was as close to Joe Weider. One of the things I tell people to indicate how close I was to Joe Weider. Joe was no literary giant. Joe could barely spell you know. Then I left school at 12. Mm-hmm. Of course, he read a lot of books.
Yeah. But
for the most part, Joey misinterpreted a lot of Nietzsche. That's the quality of stuff the man read, philosophy. But yeah. How the hell are you going to interpret philosophy when you dropped out of school at 12?
Right.
That's why all the mispronounced words come from.
Yeah.
You know. But Joe, I remember being in New Jersey. Far back as that. Was it New Jersey? Maybe not. Maybe it's just California. No, it was New Jersey. We're still in New York.
Okay.
And Joe had a photograph of Sergio. And he calls me to the desk in the department, whatever you call it now, where we did all the artwork and stuff, the art department.
Uh-huh.
And Joe has those two. He has Sergio's picture. And it's like an Elvis fan, a 13-year-old fan, but yeah. Elvis at his peak.
Yeah.
pre-army. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And that was Joe Wheeler, grown man, and that was his enthusiasm over that picture.
Yeah.
And he's looking at the picture and he's shaking his head, Ricky, come have a look at that. So I'm looking at this and Joe is looking. He says, poor Arnold. Poor Arnold. Because he figured Arnold could never beat this guy.
Right.
But, you know, the problem that arose, even in the last thing, Sergio would not compete. Everybody tried to, Julie Levine, sadly, I heard he passed away.
Yeah, I heard that too, yeah.
Yeah. All of those guys who had connections with Sergio tried to get him to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And he only agreed to come back when I assured him it would not be fixed.
Okay.
Of course, the Sergio who appeared against Lee Haney and Kyrie and all those guys were all in super shape. They're at their best. And Sergio had 2-3 years off. He'd been shot. And Sergio was still no joke.
Yeah.
But Sergio really did not deserve any more than 8 best.
Yeah.
You know, and right away he figured, oh, just exactly what I expected. They've shafted me. And I don't know, I was inspired that night. I was standing at the front of the stage, out of camera range, and I just knew, he came to the mic, and I just knew what was going to be. Madison Square Garden would have seen something they'd never seen before. I fully expected him to break that mic, toss it, maybe even attack a judge. He wasn't that kind of, and I don't know why, what inspired it. His wife was in the second row, and I said, give me the baby. And I grabbed the baby and said, Sergio, kiss your baby here. And that picture is iconic now.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know, I remember I was back home a few years, and I got a letter from Sergio Jr. And tells me, well, I was a baby. He says, Jesus, how time flies.
I know.
You know, little baby and Sergio now.
Yeah.
And over the years, I've kind of studied those guys and wondered, he's had some problems, right? The parenting problems and so on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's almost out of it now, isn't he?
He's still competing, yeah, but he's not in the Olympia this year. He's not doing as well as, you know, he wants to.
And I think it's a head trip.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a head trip.
Yeah.
And he has a lot of problems also accepting Sergio on the one hand, the superstar, iconic person who was my dad, but then he was not my dad. But he was not really my dad. That must be a hell of a burden to. I wrote him a couple of times, and he's always very grateful and you know, appreciative.
Yeah.
Of what I wrote, but shall we get to the Monster Brigade, or is that, or you still want to deal with the good old the wonderful days?
Yeah, I still want to deal with the good old days.
Well, when
did you first meet Sergio, Rick?
I met him at the second Olympia.
Okay.
And I remember
56.
Oh, that famous episode. You know those dates, man. What year was it?
66. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Because Larry won
the second one.
Larry won the first.
Yeah, he won the first and the second, yeah.
First and second, right? Yeah. Well, the first one, Sergio, or maybe the second. It's either the first or the second. But I met the first one.
It was Larry, Harold Poole, and
oh, Earl, I mean, his first from Sergio.
Oh, yeah, that was 66, yeah.
First for Sergio. And we were in the dressing room about 3 o'clock.
Okay.
I don't know why we were there, but Arnold, myself, and Franco, because we were the boys from Europe. So we were there. And Sergio was in there pumping up in this white butcher's overalls, yeah, all the way down to his ankles.
Yeah.
And Hi, Ricky. You know, Ricky Baby. No, is that what he said?
Yeah, Ricky Baby.
Ricky Baby. That was quite popular one time. Probably Ricky Baby. Okay. So, and he continued working out. So I introduced him to Arnold and Franco. And 3 o'clock, and he's already pumping up for later. Can you believe this?
Wow. I heard that's about that. Yeah. You
know? So, at one point, not paying too much attention to either guys, but they're studying him. Arnold was in this business of psyching people out.
Yes.
And he and Franco would combine. Sometimes they would even bring me in on it to psych people out, you know. So Sergio, when he's through now, so he takes off the overalls and he stretches. And Arnold's head went straight to Franco. And when Sergio had left the room, Franco says to Arnold, "Don't worry, Arnold. It's the lighting in here." And Arnold's response was, "Fuck the lighting." He said, "No fucking lighting can make anybody look like that."
Right.
And I cracked up. You know, no fucking lighting can make anyone look like that. But Franco was always doing this with Arnold.
Right, always pumping him up.
That was another fascinating relationship.
Yeah.
That people only saw the magazine thing of it, but they don't know a lot of the things that went on privately. Arnold loved Franco. Franco was umbilically tied to Arnold. Arnold caused Joe Weider to bring him over and everything.
Right.
But don't ever think it was easy being Arnold's friend. I say that to my friends as well. Often, my best friends are the ones who get the worst from me. You know, because you talk straight to them and it happens.
Well,
Arnold or something like that with Franco, except it went a lot further than that. Have you ever seen a picture of Arnold on his knees in a knee pose,
mm-hmm,
with Franco standing up?
No.
It doesn't exist.
Right.
And
but it's in the opposite.
It's exact opposite.
Yeah.
I have never heard anybody comment on that.
Yeah, right. That's true.
And that is worthy of comment.
Yeah.
If Arnold is on his knees, he's alone.
Right.
Any knee pose, he's alone.
Right. That's true. That's
and it was calculated.
Yeah.
Arnold was always, when Arnold first was photographed by Artie Zeller,
mm-hmm,
he said to Artie, "I couldn't wait to get to Santa Monica so you could photograph me and make me look bigger than the mountains." because Artie would take the shots low.
Yeah.
And so the physique would be over the hills.
Yeah. Okay?
Even that's how meticulous Arnold was.
Yeah.
Arnold was meticulous, always calculating.
Yeah.
Let me give you another episode of him. At one point, in fact, the same time of the Terminator thing I told you about earlier on,
uh-huh,
I interviewed him because he'd just done Conan. And while we were talking, this beautiful little puppy, Labrador, I guess it must have been, came into the room and said, "Wow, what a beautiful dog," and all this. So when he got it, and he told me, I think Cameron gave it to him, the producer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I gave it to him. And I said, "Well, what's it called?" He says, "What else?" I said, "What?" He says, "Conan." So we talked for a while. I left. And then I'm driving down the Santa Monica freeway. Wow, I got an idea. I pull up to the side and park. And I call him. I'm all excited. And by the way, That is what makes the writing sing. And, you know, Nicole is sitting there next to me, and she's more or less saying she hasn't seen me as excited as this for a long time. So with all the delay, I'm obviously enjoying myself going back with you, because you also know. So I'm all excited, and I call her. I said, oh, my God, the perfect title for the interview. She says, what is it? So I said, Conan is a dog. He said, yeah, that's great. That's great. So I go home, and I was due to come to the Caribbean for a vacation. So about 3 days later, on the evening before my flight, he calls me up. He says, Rick, you know that thing about the article? You've done it, right? You've done the article. I said, yeah. He said, I think you should change the title. I said, why? He says, you have those kind of fans that you have, and Americans think a certain way, they're going to read that title and they won't even read the article, because you said, and he's so right about that, you know. I don't know how those things occurred to Arnold with no training and no coaching. They were natural. He was so perspicacious. He's so sensitive to stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he said, and he did it so many times. Of course, he stole here and there too, like Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. So I said, why? And he says, they'll read the title, and they're going to decide what you're saying there is the movie's crap.
Mm.
I says, nah. He said, but it's a risk, right? He said, we don't have to take that risk. So I said, okay, I'll change the title. I left a note to Joe Weider, sent a note to Joe. I called him, and I said, Arnold is not happy with the title. I told him why, and the next morning I went on vacation. Normally, when I came back from vacation, I have a ton of calls and everything else. Arnold called twice, and the girl says to me, he's quite angry, etc. So he called me about the second day I was back, and he said, Rick, how could you do this to me? I said, do what? He said, we talked. I said, talk about what? And he said, have you read the article? I said, no. He said, well, read the article and then call me afterwards. So I read the article. I pick up the magazine. And it's no longer Conan is a dog. It now is Arnold is a dog.
Oh.
So I'm shocked. Okay, so I said, Arnold has had nothing to do with me. I gave him all the details. So the next day, Arnold calls Joe Weider. And the next day, and the next day, and the next day, Dad told Joe that he's unhappy with what happened there. And Joe just dismissed me, you know. Ah. Because I told him his love affair really was with Perignon.
Mm.
But Perignon could not deliver the goods. So Arnold filled in. And this is not to say he wasn't crazy about Arnold. But he loved the humility of Lou Ferrigno. And with the hearing, so Ferrigno is not perfect.
Yeah.
And that appealed to, and always so nice. But Arnold was always ribbing somebody, pulling them up, arrogant as shit. So while he loved Arnold, if only Arnold could be like Sergio. Like Ferrigno.
Yeah.
So Joe wouldn't take his call. So one day we were in the photo room, the photo library, sorting out photographs for the next issue, and the phone is right on the table that we're sharing, Joe and me, and the phone rings. I pick it up, and I said, is he there? And I handed it to Joe, for you. Oh, Arnold, I'm so sorry, Arnold. How can I make it up to you, Arnold? I don't know what happened, Arnold. That went on for a good 5 minutes, and evidently what can Arnold has done. The phone was barely back in the crater when Joe says, that cocksucker, he says. I apologized, but it's done. Another lesson for Rick Wayne.
Yeah.
When people tell you they're sorry, check it out.
Yeah.
They've done what they wanted to do, and now they're, I'm sorry, and they expect you to forgive them. They have to pay for that.
Right.
Another lesson learned.
What did Arnold think about that article you wrote, Arnold, Saint or Devil? Remember that? Or Angel or Devil?
My God.
I
forgot to know that. I don't think he was too happy with it. I remember we were at the bicycle restaurant in Santa Monica, and he's inviting, but what he does is inviting things so he can talk.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very, very pissed off about it. Very, very pissed off. He says, but I said, but Arnold, I give two sides. He said, yeah, but that was much more about the devil.
Right.
I said, so it was much. Diane Bennett was there, and Diane Bennett was close to him. And yeah. You think, but yeah, that's fair, Arnold. No, there was much more about the devil than there was a saint. So to hell with what you said, it was the devil he was concentrating on.
Right.
And shortly, as a matter of fact, and shortly after his wedding, Us Magazine, I don't think it's there anymore, Us Magazine. All the magazines have disappeared.
Yeah.
Us Magazine did a spread on the wedding. And among the things in the story was Arnold being asked about Kurt Waldheim,
mm-hmm.
who was the Secretary General of the UN. And he was having problems because they had discovered he had Nazi connections and so on.
Yeah.
So the reporters at the wedding, Cardinal Arnold, who was a master at handling reporters, master, and they asked him, well, what do you think is going to happen to your friend Kurt, fellow Austrian, huh? And he said, Kurt is having a bad press, but it'll blow over. Everything will be all right. At the time, I was a major radical. Wow. Almost a Black Panther. Almost.
Yes.
Not quite. And it pissed me off.
Yeah.
So I wrote in Miscellaneous what he had said to us. And I said, I agree with him. And I expect all the stories about Idi Amin and Bokassa and all these ogres, they were so bad press, it'll blow over. Arnold was so pissed off, I didn't hear from him for about 4 months.
Wow.
And normally when we traveled from Los Angeles to Columbus, Ohio, we would share the same seats, opposite seats, you know?
Yeah.
I saw him, he ignored me, I ignored him. We got on a plane, he went to his own seat and I went to mine. We got to Columbus and the reporters are there and they would check us together. And when he picked up his stuff, did not go on the bus, took a taxi and went up. Then the next day at the prejudging, after the prejudging, there are all those reporters now. And then suddenly one guy says, what's with you two guys? Because normally, So I said, he asked Arnold, what's with you two guys? And Arnold says, ask him. So the guy says, what's wrong? What's wrong, Rick? I said, I don't know. So when they left, he says to me, and you know, this monster big guy and everything, Arnold, in a voice that made me feel like a turd, he says, start complaining. So I says, well, you didn't complain about the Us Magazine and that article, all that bullshit there about Kurt Waldheim. He says, Ricky, they paid for my wedding. They paid all the expenses. Mm. What do you want me to do? You want me to start getting on with those people? Yeah, welcome. But, Ricky, you're my friend. Mm. Oh. Oh. I felt I had betrayed my mother, my whole family, everybody dear to me. I had betrayed. And then we shook hands. I still have the photograph of us making up. I have it in my
oh, really? Wow.
I still have that.
Yeah.
But I don't think nearly enough has been written about Arnold, because there's so little that the writers know about the parts of him that are not obvious.
Yeah.
And always they're dealing with Arnold the Terminator, Arnold the movie star, Arnold the champion. They're not dealing with Arnold.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like all the stories about his mother and his father and all, those things have become legend.
Yeah.
And most of them only have true Mm-hmm. It's like the pump is like coming.
Yeah.
Remember that famous one? That's not an Arnold original.
Right.
That was given to him by Butler.
Yeah.
Arnold made it his own. The first article I wrote about Arnold in England when I was suggesting to Joe Weider to get him over and so on and so on. Because I was the one who recommended that Joe Weider bring him over.
Okay.
And the title of the article was, "If Hercules were alive today, he'd be called Arnold Schwarzenegger."
Right, right.
That was the very first article I wrote about him. Yeah. I have heard Arnold say that so many times to reporters.
Yeah.
Like it's an original. Why not?
Yeah.
Muhammad Ali did it a number of times with Archie Moore.
Sure. Yeah.
So what the hell?
Do you still talk to Arnold?
I have not talked with Arnold in a long time, but every time he does something special, he would send me a book. He invited me over to the Franco's Memorial, I was going to go. But, man, with my bad back, I got a very bad...
you do? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It even affects mobility. Mm. And age, too, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But all I hurt my back in a car accident while on vacation here, and did nothing. You remember when I didn't enter the Olympia because of my shoulder?
In 76, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's my God. And that year, oh man, training at Vince's, and I remember Frank Zane saying to a reporter on stage, what was the show? Wild World of Sports.
Yeah, Wild World of Sports, yeah.
And they were interviewing Frank and asked him who was his greatest competition there, who did he fear most, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, "I hope he doesn't mind, but Rick Warren, who is in a bed in Los Angeles right now, that is..." I was in incredible shape.
Wow.
And I did very few pictures, very, very... And I remember, what's his name now, a Mexican guy who died... But he did a lot of pictures. He was a photographer for, I forget his name now, a Mexican. He died a short you wouldn't know him, I guess.
He died recently?
Oh, no. He died a good 20 years ago.
Oh, okay.
So he begged me, "Come, let's do pictures." I did about one or two, and that was it.
Okay.
But I was in such great shape. I mean, Vince and all the guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Figured that nobody could touch because I really did train for that.
Yeah.
And I was doing a one-arm row, and I just felt a zap in my left arm and neck. I went to Dick Tyler, and Dick Tyler put me on a machine, no x-ray, nothing. And to cut a long story short, by the time I got home, I couldn't raise my arm. Mm. And the spasms, if somebody had given me a pill out of this crap, I would have taken it.
Wow.
But it was worth it to hear Frank say that the guy he was most worried about was Rick Warren. Bill Reynolds wrote a lot about that, too.
Do you remember when Frank had that dream where he was, I think he chopped somebody's head with a mask on, and then he...
I don't remember the dreams at all.
Yeah.
I don't remember the dreams at all, those stories. I don't remember those details.
Yeah.
I haven't read them in a long, long time.
Yeah, I think it was right before the 76 Olympics.
But he had a dream for everyone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone.
He had this axe, and he chopped this guy's head, and it was you.
Oh, I remember that. Yes.
You had the pain in your neck. That was
That's right.
I interviewed Frank like a year ago or two, and I asked him about that. He said he didn't remember. But I got the magazine where he said it. You know?
Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, I forgot it, but I wrote it. So
yeah.
No surprise that he'd have forgotten it. But Arnold was generally okay with it. He trusted me with his articles.
Yeah.
But just one or two, because at that time he's gotten so into the movies and gotten so sensitive. So very, very competitive.
Did you see him change, Rick, as a person, as he got more
family? I talked with Balik.
Yeah.
About a couple of years. John and I good friends. You interviewed him too, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Balik, I asked him, I said, "I've been watching Arnold delivering all those anti-Trump, pissing on racism and the underdog and whatever." I said, "Is that real?" And John said to me, Rick, you know Arnold better than I did. I picked him up at the airport. It was he who picked Arnold up at the airport when he first came to California.
Wow, okay.
So that's how far back they go. And he reminded me that. He said, I picked this guy up, et cetera, but I don't think anybody knows Arnold as well as you do. Because I get to know people that way. I don't just deal with the superficial. I go with a psyche. I get to know people in ways other people. I have my own perspective on everybody.
Yeah.
And that's what I write about.
Yeah.
So he said, you know better than I do. But I call these people for an interview, for some time with Arnold, and I wanted only 10 minutes because Arnold's so busy. So, and he said I spent about 2.5 hours with Arnold. Arnold stopped everything and talked with him for 2 hours. So he said, I believe he has undergone a kind of road to Damascus conversion, and he really believes he's serious, he's genuine. So I'm prepared to believe it because he's even if he doesn't mean it in his soul, it comes across like he means it, and it has its effect.
Yeah,
I thought he was very, very, very brave when he talked about. What was it? He says, fuck freedom. What was it he said?
Screw your freedoms, yeah.
Screw your freedoms. I empathize with that because only a few weeks ago, actually, I got pretty annoyed with St. Lucia, the people of St. Lucia, for their laziness and not standing up for anything. And I said, I'm fed up being the one to stand up for everything. And I ended it up without thinking. And I said, and screw all of you.
Yeah.
And later on, I didn't regret it. I meant that.
Yeah.
And it was great to see Arnold stand up behind what he said. Because what he was saying is screw your freedom, but it doesn't end there. It talks about you are putting your idea of freedom ahead of lives and whatever.
Yes. Yeah, that's what he meant.
So you can take him. You can take him as literally, or you can take him as that you're speaking metaphorically, or it was just whatever. You can do what you want with that.
Yeah.
But what I admired was that he didn't try to squirm out of it, and but he stood by it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think those people who spoke against him were people who were not in love with him in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because even if you might have been pissed off. And I know Americans. I know Americans and freedom.
Right.
People who have not lived in mainstream America don't really appreciate how you guys, but freedom means to you guys.
Yeah.
Ironic, because while America is so hot, I'm going to get you with a controversial bomb here, John. Get ready for it. While America is so into the freedom, the free country, the land of what? Land of the free and all that. All the stuff.
Right.
It appears to certain people that freedom is only worth something when they are free.
Right.
Okay, not necessarily the freedom for other people. And that's as diplomatic as I can get.
Yeah, exactly.
If you appreciate freedom, appreciate it for everything. But you know, I don't know if it's because if you dare not ask me, I don't know. But I wanted to ask you. You can ask me any question you want. Because the matter of color and race and whatever.
Oh yeah, I wanted to get to your famous article about our black bodybuilders being treated fairly. The cover story.
I want to say to Nicole while she's watching this and I'm on air, she's a journalist. Yeah. And I want to use you, if you don't mind,
as
when a guy has done his research, how interesting it is to talk to him.
Thank you.
And she interviewed Derek Walcott, the Nobel Prize winner, once. I will not tell you that story. <She's sitting there. laughs> But you know the stories well. What was it? What was the one you just brought up?
Our black bodybuilders being treated fairly. And they had a cover. And, it was a cover with Robbie and
yeah, and yeah. And it was about, I wrote more than one.
It was right after the 77 Olympia when Robbie
won. And I remember writing one that I am very proud of because the lighting it shows was what I concentrated on.
Oh, okay.
And I thought it was controversial even among the black bodybuilders of America. They never considered me black.
Mm-hmm.
They like to say, oh, he's from the islands. And they were talking as the islands, they meant Hawaii, because most of them weren't familiar with the Caribbean islands.
Okay.
So I went through that kind of crap as well. I'm not black. Of course I'm black. But black for them would be Robbie Robinson. And yeah, a number of times these guys would have meetings because they had problems in their minds about, at least, about being treated unfairly because they were black and whatever. And they never invited me to those meetings. Number one, they should have, because I would be able to write about it and do something about it. I had enough influence with Rita, etc. But it never bothered me. Now, that whole race thing is such crap anyway, people dealing with shades or whatever. At the end of the day, bodybuilding is not racist. But it's nice to be able to shout racism if you're black enough and you lost.
Mm.
Robbie was fantastic when Robbie was on.
Yeah.
But Robbie was enigmatic because Robbie was never in control of Robbie.
Mm. Okay, yeah.
Whereas Frank Zane and those other guys would go to with the lighting man to check out the lights for their skin tone, Robbie would be sleeping and not necessarily ordinary sleep, if you get my drift.
Right.
Okay? So then he would come, and the photographs would be taken, and you could barely see him because the lighting was set up for lighter skin.
Yeah, yeah.
So he did himself a disservice. And I wrote about that, and that changed. Wendy Mealy and the rest of the guys took that on and they changed it. And now, the Olympias that I saw, those were productions.
Yeah.
They were really good. I don't know right now. I think it's more like a market now with booths and.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the lighting because there is this big controversy in today's bodybuilding and especially like on all the pro shows, but especially the Olympia too, because they have these really beautiful stages, but they've got all this stuff going on behind them, like a video screen, you know, and they got the sponsors stuff flashing. And back in the Columbus days, you know, the Mr. Olympia was just that black background. And I think everybody thought that was the perfect lighting for bodybuilding.
I never thought there was any racism in bodybuilding. There was in the AAU.
Because
I dealt with some of that myself. I was in Paris representing England in the Mr. Europe.
Yeah.
And I remember Bob Hoffman, who I never really had much time for. And Bob Hoffman came up to me. He was with Val Vasilev.
Val Vasilev, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And with Mr. America. And he hoped. And I don't remember why he was there. Maybe it was for the Mr. Universe.
That was the FIHC?
FIHC.
That was the first one you went in, right, Rick?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And I should have won.
Yeah, right.
Abdul El Gindi, nice guy, though. But the guy was like, I should have won. That's not the only one I should have won.
Right.
You know that shot, that iconic shot with Arnold and Franco? And
yeah, the
I should have won that damn contest.
Yeah.
But I didn't care. I really didn't care. I was far more interested in writing about the excitement and whatever. And that picture. That picture, there were three or four takes of that picture.
Okay.
And let me dismiss that racism thing quickly. There was no racism in bodybuilding, and Joe Weider didn't give a damn who won the contest. And if you think about it, whoever won the contest, Joe Weider would promote him on the et cetera. So he wins anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
It didn't really matter. It put him on the cover of a magazine and give him all the stuff and get him the contracts and everything out. So Joe Rita had no real reason. Like the booing contest, Joe said right there to me that this is terrible. I'm leaving. And he was on his way. I said, you got to stand here. And they wanted him to come on stage anyway, but he was leaving because he figured Callender should have won. Roy was in awesome shape.
He was. Yeah, I was there. Yeah, I saw that show. Yeah.
Oh, you were there for that.
I was there, yeah.
And which Arnold later said, and Arnold was recovering from Australia, right?
Right.
So when, and he went through hell with that. I did some interviews with him, talked with him. He was very, very hurt, very bruised by all of that.
Yeah.
But don't let me forget about the Olympia. But I remember him saying to me after I interviewed him, and he was really down, and he said, but the positives of that guy, you know, he's as broken as he was, as I was walking out, he says to me, but you know what, Rick? 8 years from now, 10 years from now, nobody will be talking about what happened, etc. They will just say Arnold won the Olympia 8 times.
Right, right. Yeah.
What a strong mind it takes to do that.
Yeah.
Now get back to what I told you not to forget about the Olympia.
Which one?
We were just talking about the Olympia. I said keep that thought.
Oh, about the black bodybuilders?
Yeah. There was no racism in there.
Yeah.
None at all. And I did the magazine, and I could tell you, Joe Wheeler has never said to me, don't write about this person or that person. Yeah. Never.
Yeah.
Sergio, with all the stuff, Joe never spoke one word to me and close to racism. He just thought, and you know, Joe Wheeler and Arnold, so many times, there's that picture of Maria, Sergio, and taking at World Gym.
The World Gym, yeah. I just saw that.
All of those pictures have a history of story behind it.
Yeah.
I was there with Sergio, really babying him, you know, because he after the contest, there's a picture of us walking from LAX.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So all of that. So we were practically babying him, and Joe, we'd appeal for everything and whatever. So, and Joe didn't even come to the session because he didn't want to upset anything. And bang, Arnold is coming up the steps with Maria in tow. And he introduces, he shook Sergio's hand, and Sergio shook his hand, but with daggers in Sergio's eyes. And of course, Sergio switches totally to Maria.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
Rick, was that after the Olympia or before?
That was after New York.
Oh, that was after 84. Okay. I always thought that was like Sergio came to California when he was getting ready for it and everybody.
No. It was after the contest.
That was after.
Contest. I flew with him from New York.
Did Arnold know that Sergio was going to be there that day?
Well, you know, Joe Gold may have told him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So Arnold came and Arnold was ready to shower this guy because he was a hero to Arnold.
Yeah.
And I remember Arnold saying to him, you stick with Rick and Rick will write and promote you and blah, 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 you know, and whatever I can do. And Sergio's reaction, only now you know Ricky is a great writer, which was stupid.
Yeah.
Because I've been writing about Arnold ever since we were in Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
And Arnold trusted me with his stories better than anybody else. Mm-hmm. So to suggest to him, to Arnold, that Arnold didn't really like me or my writing. He said, only now you know, Rick, you can write, you know.
Yeah.
So we let that go. And but it went right over Arnold's head. It didn't bother him. And Arnold talked to Joe about treating Sergio well and giving him whatever he got, contracts or whatever Joe paid him for endorsements at that time or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's the same as with Ferrigno. He never told in all the debate that was going on, Ferrigno was putting him down. And he could have said, look, man, shut the hell up. I got you this thing, even though you don't know it. He never did that.
Yeah.
So that is, those are the aspects that make the whole man. Somebody important said that if you're going to judge a man, don't do that before you have considered his good points.
Okay.
Don't start thinking of his bad points.
Yeah.
Because
if
you only think of bad points, you won't even go to the good points. So consider his good points at least before you go dismissing him for the bad.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
And Arnold suffers a bit of that. When he was running for governor, I was saying, my phone in St. Lucia did not stop ringing. Every paper, the B from San Francisco, everybody looking for dirt.
Really?
Everybody looking for dirt.
Yeah.
And there was the famous one that Wendy Lee wrote. And I think he, we talked about apartheid. I think it said that if the blacks take over in South Africa, Africa, that too will fail like all the other black states had failed. Now, that can sound racism, racist.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the problem I have.
Yeah.
Africa at that time was a, I may still be. The problem of Africans against Africans may still be. I don't know. I don't keep up with this anymore. Mm-hmm. But what he said, though uncomfortable, was a hard truth. But that caused a whole stir. And then I went to England. I remember going to England. And I got a call from an affiliate of ABC television from the state. They had an affiliate in London. Mm-hmm. And they sent out this limo to pick me up and everything to interview me. And near the end of the interview, the producer then says to the guy interviewing me, you haven't asked him about Arnold being a racist. And so he put the question, do you think Arnold is a racist because of what he said about South Africa? I said, it's interesting that nobody ever asked me what my response to Arnold was. Because if you heard my response, you would think I was the racist.
Mm.
They never asked. But of course, I'm referring to Austria and Austria's roots and a certain gentleman with a mustache.
Yeah. Okay.
So that was my answer to you. But Arnold and I talked about everything. Some subjects we didn't talk about because they might cause a stir if he was in the mood.
Okay.
For example, well, this is a lot earlier when Arnold first came, right at the time he was doing this famous Hercules in New York, that bomb.
Yeah.
So there we were at the Sheraton Hotel in the dining room. Myself, Franco, a few others, and Joe Weider. Betty Weider was at the time in California. So Joe Weider had his penthouse and he had this blue Cadillac.
Okay.
Arnold walks in. Hi, guys. And he goes straight to the hat check girl who had just come in a few minutes earlier, a black girl, a hat check. He goes to the girl, talks to her, comes back, goes again, and then he comes back to Joe. Joe, can I borrow your car and your penthouse? I mean, if Arnold asked Joe to jump up the Times building, he would do it. So I give him the keys, and Arnold is gone. So the next morning, I learned, by the way, Joe was sitting by himself for a long time. The next morning, Arnold comes to the office, sits down, and he's talking to me about this wonderful time he had with this girl.
Yeah.
And bragging. So, and then he gets up, and as he's going out my cubicle, he says, and Ricky, she says, I am the best she ever had. And he walks out the cubicle, then pokes his head back, including the black guys.
Of course. Didn't know that was coming, right?
Oh, those stories. Arnold was... Because there were times I would say to him, I can't believe what's happening to you, man. Yeah. You know, because I knew Arnold way back in London and Germany.
Yeah.
And you know, Arnold, look what's happening. And it's just happening. Everything can be tumbling his way. This guy can't do anything wrong. He has the guy with the Midas touch and everything. So I said, look, I can't believe this. You know? What is it about you, man? And he says, well, I am good looking. I have the greatest physique in the world. I am smart. And again, he walks out. And he pokes his head. Same way. And I'm white. You see, that is the humor. He knew the kind of stuff. So he will hold that until he gets out of the office, my cubicle, and is on his way out.
Right.
He drops that, but he's a generous guy. You know, I would ask Arnold for interviews. And imagine this, the control Arnold had as well. How many bodybuilders would get an opportunity to do interviews for Flex and Muscle and Fitness at the time, and they would say no, which for later? And if they get an opportunity to be in there every day, they would be in there. Not Arnold. It got to a time when Arnold would not do interviews and tell me, let's hold it, because he had something to promote.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think of Arnold's background, you wonder where he acquired this kind of perspicacity, you know, and that's what you don't hear people talking about. Right. They just figure, but Arnold was a different kind of bodybuilder. Arnold himself is a different kind of man.
Yeah.
And that's what made him the champion he was. Okay. That's what makes him, got him into the politics. That's what made him in, who the hell knows where Arnold got the line about girly men?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, everybody was talking about the girly man.
Right.
You know, and his thing with Trump. He could have chosen to bury the hatchet with Trump.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he does the exact opposite.
Right.
He's not afraid to take chances.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he does it with everything he's got.
Yeah, yeah. I've always been a big fan of Arnold. And I don't know if you've ever heard the story. He was supposed to be on the first time on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. He had been on the Tonight Show before with the co-host or with the other guests, you know, like the featured guest. But this was the first time with Johnny, and his book, Education of a Bodybuilder, had just
come out. That's right. I remember that.
Yeah. And Johnny wanted to pose with Arnold. And Arnold told his people, he said, no, I'm going out there with a suit. He goes, I'm retired from bodybuilding. I'm not doing it. How many bodybuilders at 30 would have turned down the Tonight Show? I mean, these bodybuilders today would do anything, to be honest.
There's a famous picture of myself, a guy called Jimmy Savile. I don't know if you've heard of Jimmy Savile.
Oh, yeah, in the NABBA universe. Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know his name is Dirt now.
Yeah, yeah.
Because,
on Netflix, yeah.
Well, at the time, he was iconic. Yeah. And I did a BBC interview with him. And it went so well. He was so kind. Invited him to lunch with my manager. He said, no. He said, I tell you what, I'll do a picture with you if you take your shirt off. And he, because he's a comedian, huh?
Yeah.
On top of everything. And he took, we took our shirts off and he did this silly pose and I did, and the picture is iconic. It's a real conversation piece. People, you knew Jimmy Savile, you know, et cetera. I have those pictures, iconic.
Yeah.
It's like a picture with Rolling Stones and those iconic pictures, unless they tell a story, not worth keeping. And almost every photograph I have, there's a story behind it. Mm-hmm. There's a story. But getting back to Arnold, bodybuilding will, all of those guys who imagine themselves replacements for Arnold, they're kidding. And I thought he was so bold and ballsy to speak out against what they have done to our bodybuilding.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think bodybuilding was at its greatest in my time, Arnold, and maybe a couple years. And I want to say quickly as well, Sean should have won the Olympia.
Sean Ray.
I can't figure, and when I see those pictures, mm-hmm. you know, Sean Ray should have won the Olympia at least once.
Yeah, I agree.
Labrada as well. He didn't win, did he? Labrada.
No, never won.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He didn't win. And who else? But these two guys, Flex Wheeler,
yeah.
I loved. I thought Flex was the last. And it's very sad it was happening to him right now.
Yeah.
But then again, it's like Arnold said, you want it bad enough, you take it. And that's what they did. I'm glad that Sean and Labrada have been. I worry about Labrada's son.
Yeah.
He came here as a baby. I had a show here.
I remember, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I worry about his son, and I hope his father is really checking him out. Like this guy Walker, come on.
Yeah, Nick Walker. Yeah, he trains at my gym, actually.
I mean, do you want to look like that?
I know, right?
Yeah. But I thought, Arnold, I won't put you on the spot for that. You probably would say yes anyway. But Arnold spoke out against it, and he still talks about it.
Yeah.
I think he's right.
Yeah.
I mean, a guy's dying, and it really pisses me off when I read on Facebook, it is with a heavy heart. The very guys who are promoting this crazy drug culture in bodybuilding.
Yeah.
It is with a heavy heart we have to report so and so.
Yeah.
They're complicit. So many guys, some of them with really great physiques, dying at 30-something. I mean, this is insane.
Yeah. Seems like a runaway train. It just keeps getting bigger, the gate being bigger and bigger and bigger every generation, every 10 years. And it's like, how do you stop?
There were also far more opportunities in mainstream America and mainstream world around that time. Pumping Iron really did a great thing for bodybuilding. And those guys have, I mean, what do you call it? Generation Iron?
Yeah.
That is the days pumping Iron.
Yeah, they tried to do a movie, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting, Rick? When I started bodybuilding in 77, that's the year Pumping Iron came out. And a couple of years later, I was competing in teenage bodybuilding shows, and they were packed. I mean, 35, 45, 55 teenagers in a show. And now teenage bodybuilding is gone. So I think the reason why it was so big before was because all those young guys that were my age, we all saw Pumping Iron, and we all wanted to be bodybuilders. We all wanted to look like Arnold. Where today's bodybuilders, they don't want to look like the guys today. So the teenage bodybuilding is gone now.
So what is the attraction of the Olympia now? Because I'm told that it's hardly any applause as compared to
not like it was. Yeah,
in New York. I mean, in New York, you only had to know the name and the place exploded.
I know. Yeah. Or look at the shows in Columbus back in the late 70s.
Exactly. Amazing. But I hear that's gone.
Yeah. And the posing is not good at all. You know, so posing doesn't,
perhaps, the one I detest most, and I've always been in trouble with that, the female bodybuilders.
Yeah.
Even when it started off, I wasn't really crazy about it because I've always had this ideal that the ideal woman with a woman's strength was not, with the size of her muscles.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to believe females are the superior gender anyway, but that's for another show.
Yeah.
You know, the strength of a woman is not in her muscles.
Yeah.
And I was in California long enough to hear these top female bodybuilders sounding like base guys, you know.
Right.
And more that I can't talk about on your show. But I didn't think, and I got a lot of heat from people like Steve Winterstrom and some other guys gave me a lot of heat. But I wondered how Steve feels about what is going on right now. Is Steve still around, you know?
I don't think so, no. I don't think he passed away. I never hear his name anymore, so.
Okay. I mean, like that back shot, where they stick their butts out. And what the hell is that about?
I know.
What is that supposed to depict? What is it they're showing the judge?
I think they're trying to show their hamstrings.
Yeah. Hamstrings?
Tie-in, yeah.
I mean, Corey showed her hamstrings.
Yeah, exactly.
Laura showed her hamstrings. Laura Bowen showed her hamstrings.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really awkward looking pose.
It's interesting in your book too, because you talked about how when Bud Parker was doing his shows, he created that Miss Americana.
Yeah.
And then he started selling out the shows when he brought that in, right?
That's right.
You said a lot of those girls didn't even work out. They, like, the one was drinking whiskey or something when she went out on stage, you know?
Yeah. You were so well researched, you know.
Yeah.
So well researched.
What did you think of Rachel? I know did you give her the name, Delish
McDish.
Oh, McDish. Okay.
Oh, they really set me up one night in New York, though. We were at this show, and Rachel, Bev Francis, and a couple others invited me on stage because it was my birthday.
Oh, okay.
I knew there was some kind of conspiracy. because all of them, because Rachel, in a nice way, Rachel enjoyed the McDish thing. Rachel was a goddess as far as the fans were concerned.
Yeah.
So I went upstage and they were wishing me happy birthday and saying all, and then all of a sudden they smashed that cake in my face, you know, and everybody went, But I knew it was coming. I just did along with that. But those were nice, great old days.
Yeah.
Now I don't see any of that. I don't even want to see the guy's pictures. I don't want to see that. Why anybody would want to look like that?
Yeah.
You know, and knowing what they have to do that.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to Rick Wayne for joining us for that interview. We will have our final interview with Rick next week when we have part three of our interview with Rick Wayne on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. That will be next week. I want to thank our Patreon donors for helping support another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. If anybody is interested in becoming a Patreon donor yourself, the link is right below in the description, or you can go to the bodybuildinglegendsshow.com website, and the link is in the upper right-hand corner. Also, I was on Dave Palumbo's show this week, and we were talking about the Rick Wayne interview, so you can check that out. I've got the link here also in the description. That was the Heavy Muscle Radio show that Dave does with Chris Aceto each week, and I was a guest on the show this week. And also be sure to check out our Muscle Maturity podcast, which is on YouTube under Old School Labs, and I do that with Samir Banute and Nick Trigilli each week. All right, guys, before I let you go, I want to read another great article by Rick Wayne, and this comes from the April 1981 issue of Muscle and Fitness. This was probably one of his most controversial articles, and I know Arnold himself really didn't like it, and it is about Arnold. So buckle in, and I'm going to read this article to you right now. It's called Arnold, Saint or Devil, A View Beyond Camera Range. Nearly a year has evaporated since that carbuncle erupted without warning on the formerly unsullied face of the Olympia. But the ensuing brouhaha still remains the number one topic of conversation in the bodybuilding world, which is hardly surprising when you consider the principles in this nightmarish controversy. There continues to be much volatile talk regarding a planned boycott of this year's Mr. Olympia. It has also been widely bruited about that the professional bodybuilders have for once banded together and unanimously voted to notify their fans via paid advertisements in bodybuilding journals of their calculated decision not to participate in the contest. This action is said to be in retaliation for what the champions maintain should never have occurred in Sydney. As if to clarify the position of the boycotting professionals, Mike Mentzer, who placed fifth in the contest, has now stated that it wasn't so much the fact that Arnold emerged monarch of all he surveyed at the Sydney Opera House that was the root of their protest. Had that been the case, Mike points out, it would have been a simple matter to lodge a complaint with the IFBB, with the not unrealistic demand that the Federation conduct a kind of in-house investigation relating specifically to the judges of the 1980 Mr. Olympia. There will always be unpopular decisions, Mike is quick to admit, no matter where bodybuilding contests are staged. However, as Mike says, there was absolutely no need for the contumelious behavior that Arnold Schwarzenegger, who has contracted to co-promote the next Mr. Olympia displayed in Australia towards the judges, fellow Mr. Olympia contenders, and the entire IFBB. He went down there with his movie crew to shoot Pumping Iron 2, complained Mentzer, and was allowed to lord it over the rest of us as if he were some superstar actor and we were bit players. He insulted us individually and collectively by his uncalled for remarks, and in the way he flouted the strict laws that govern IFBB events all over the world. He showed complete disregard for all the rules that we had agreed to compete by. Implicit in Mike Mentzer's statement is the suggestion that if the IFBB cannot legally take the 1981 Mr. Olympia out of Arnold's hands, since contracts were signed 2 years ago, there's nothing to prevent the leading Mr. Olympia contenders from doing everything lawful in their power to repay Arnold for his indiscretions. So if a competitor like Boyer Coe, one of the leading figures in the protest demonstration, thought the intervening months would have returned the bodybuilding scene to normalcy, if he thought that it was enough time for the Mr. Olympia furor to die down, recently he had cause to think again. For as he sat at a restaurant table with a group that included a Hollywood writer, a magazine publisher, and three well-known bodybuilders, the cause célèbre that is threatening to become ever more bodybuilding's Black Friday once again reared its polemic head. The thing that bothers me most about all this, Coe said, conceivably for the 100th time since last November, was what Arnold reportedly told a magazine writer shortly after the contest in Australia. He said he had entered the Olympia only because he thought Mike Mentzer and I needed to be taught a lesson. Now, I really don't know much about his relationship with Mike, but I always thought of him as a friend, and with the added understanding that we've held each other in high regard. For him to suggest I had done him in some justice in the past that merited revenge, well, that's the part that hurts the most. Clearly, Boyer Coe had never really gotten to know Arnold Schwarzenegger, at least not nearly as well as, say, Frank Zane, who was one of the first members of Arnold's Santa Monica Rat Pack back in 1967, when the Austrian first arrived in California and took it more or less permanent residence at Gold's Gym in Venice. Frank and Dave Draper were among the first to train with Arnold. You saw their pictures in Muscle Builder, now Muscle and Fitness, each month, squatting with ponderous barbells, fooling around at Venice Beach, posing for Artie Zeller and Tijuana. Yes, they were very much to bodybuilding in those days what Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Peter Lawford, Sammy Davis Jr., and the rest of the famous clan were to Hollywood for the 60s. Doubtless Zane must, in the early days, have considered Schwarzenegger a most magnanimous fellow. For shortly before Arnold signed on the dotted line for Joe Weider, a step that later turned out to be a giant leap toward every ambition that Arnold ever held dear, Frank Zane had been the sharp needle that punctured the Austrian's overinflated ego. The whole truth of that historic matter was that Arnold, then 21, a three-time winner of the NABBA Mr. Universe title and fully convinced of his invincibility, had entered the 1968 IFBB Mr. Universe contest in fat and marble white condition. And Zane, having decided that mass did not necessarily a winner make, had no great difficulty teaching the European upstart a thing or two about the real world of professional bodybuilding. Of course, Zane was not to know how Arnold really felt about his loss. Zane joined Arnold after Joe Weider had, not altogether altruistically, established the Austrian in Santa Monica. Before long, Frank was sharing his precious non-bodybuilding moments on the archery field with his new arrival. Later, Arnold induced Joe Weider to import Franco Colombo to California. Franco and Arnold had been buddies for years, and in Germany, they had been inseparable. It was not difficult for Joe to understand that even though Zane, Artie Zeller, Dick Tyler, Zabel Kwaszewski, Eddie Giuliani, and the rest of the Santa Monica fan club were sometimes great fun to be with, none of them could ever hope to fill the place in Arnold's heart that Franco occupied. In the interest of his star's peace of mind, and let us say here that Joe must have had his eye on his investment in Arnold, the Master Blaster complied with the Austrian's request. Those in a position to know have suggested that Franco's arrival in California coincided with the surfacing of Arnold's true feelings regarding American bodybuilders. These people claim, though Joe Weider himself remains noncommittal on the matter, that at about this time, the publisher began to hear stories about West Coast disloyalty that were not calculated to enhance the position of certain previously venerated stars at Weider headquarters. Certainly, a casual journey through the Weider journals of the day tends to give substance to the suggestion that Dave Draper, Zane, and others all but disappeared from the magazine upon the arrival of Arnold and Franco. Oh, Larry Scott still dominated the pages, but then the great Scott was in a class by himself, with a very special spot in Joe Weider's heart. Sergio Oliva also appeared with some regularity, but you get the feeling that he was there mainly to fire up the imagination of the fans who were already itching for a Sergio-Arnold confrontation. It was about this time that Arnold took to calling American bodybuilders paper tigers. Arnold's first encounter with Sergio Oliva occurred in September 1969 at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. The packed house had already seen the Austrian easily win that year's Mr. Universe Award earlier that evening. Indeed, Arnold's win had been anticlimactic. There was something thickly deja vu about it. The hero himself said later that the Mr. Universe title was merely the aperitif before the planned feast. But Arnold's dream was not to be. He failed to take the Mr. Olympia title away from Sergio. However, by the way he rattled Sergio, it was clear that the Cuban would experience difficulty holding Arnold off in the future. The writing was on the wall in bold neon letters. Over the next year, even though he had on that night of the Mr. Olympia planted a nice smacking kiss on Sergio's sweaty cheek, Arnold went about waging psychological warfare against Oliva at every opportunity. He took to calling American bodybuilders chicken for having allowed the Cuban to rise as he had, virtually unchallenged. He noted over and over again that American bodybuilders were sissies who led a pampered existence. And in the process, said Arnold, the bodybuilders of this country had grown soft and lost their ambition. Naturally, Franco echoed his sentiments while promising that in no time at all, he and Arnold would dominate world bodybuilding. Certainly, they already dominated the bodybuilding mind. Then came Arnold's first win against Sergio Oliva. The contest was staged in Columbus, Ohio by Jim Lorimer, the same Lorimer who would, in time, become Arnold's business partner and co-promoter of the Mr. Olympia and other top IFBB shows. For one reason or another, however, the event that occurred in Columbus was never taken seriously by the bodybuilding community. It seemed everyone was more interested in the outcome of the scheduled encounter between the two a few weeks later. Arnold and Sergio met at a Manhattan theater in late September 1970. Picture this. Arnold and Franco are backstage, attired in street clothes, seemingly unperturbed by the dressing room commotion, apparently unconcerned that the Mr. Olympia contest is scheduled to commence in less than 30 minutes. Sergio Oliva is also present, wearing posing trunks under a pair of overalls large enough to serve as a tent for camping girls. He appears particularly large this night as he performs curl after curl and push-up after push-up in the small room. Arnold and Franco watch Oliva with detached interest for a while, and then suddenly Franco says in fractured American, "Arnold, what you say we go find something to eat? We got time, yes?" "Yes," says Arnold, "we have time. Maybe we get some French fries with ketchup." At which point Sergio dropped the barbell in open amazement. "You going to eat now?" he said. "You know the time. Ain't you guys going to pump up?" He himself had been doing just that for over an hour. "Pump up?" asked Arnold, allowing some of his acting ambitions to show. "What for?" "If you ain't got the muscle now, Sergio, you're dead. Pumping ain't going to do nothing for you, babe." Enough was enough. Sergio dropped his huge bulk onto the soft cushions of a couch and then placed both hands on his forehead. You have to understand that until then, no one had had sufficient nerve to talk to Oliva in other than deep reverential tones. He had been God for a long time. So when Arnold laid on him that line about the French fries with ketchup to boot, the whole thing must have hit Sergio's self-confidence with the impact of a nuclear bomb. In truth, even though Arnold and Franco walked out of the dressing room, ostensibly in search of a fast food restaurant, they never actually left the theater. Indeed, while Sergio continued to sweat backstage, Franco and Arnold were in the auditorium enjoying a posing exhibition by Frank Zane. With only 10 minutes to go before the curtain came up on the Mr. Olympia contest, Arnold and his Sardinian sidekick re-entered the dressing room to find Sergio still in his overalls, still pumping, pumping, pumping. Wordlessly, Arnold changed into his posing trunks, then offered his body to Franco for the ritual anointing with oil. At last, the moment arrived. Arnold was first out. The cheers that greeted his appearance on stage echoed backstage with the force of a hurricane. And through it all, Sergio continued to sweat. He had discarded the butcher's overalls by this time, and now his exposed belly pumped in and out, like the bellows in an old-time blacksmith's shop. Clearly, desperation was warehousing in Sergio's liver. He reminded you more of a jaded heavyweight wrestler than a Mr. Olympia fighting to retain his title. When Oliva's name was called for posing, he turned to the writer and said, "Would you mind coming to the side of the stage and calling to me when I step wrong?" I had been Sergio's number one fan through other hellfires before this one. Implicit in the plea was the sad admission that the essence of Sergio's self-confidence had flowed with his perspiration onto the dressing room floor. Without laying a hand on the Cuban, Arnold had devastated his not minuscule ego. Sergio was, from that moment, on one of the Walking Dead. He posed like a bumbling neophyte that night, and even though he received loud applause, something in the sound of a hand clapping reminded you of the saddest goodbyes. The pose down confirmed the obvious, that nothing Sergio could do this night would save him from defeat. While Arnold glided effortlessly from one practice pose to the next, Sergio Oliva fumbled, slipped, appeared to totter, and his belly pumped in and out like some huge caterpillar below his pectorals. While the winning formula was lean and skin, the man was fat. Soon Arnold was striking five mind-boggling poses for every half-hearted effort on Sergio's part. God, a decade later, the memory of my hero being crucified is still painful. At one point during the pose down, Sergio walked off stage. He returned only when sections of the disappointed audience began to boo. Yes, that was how Sergio bit the dust at Arnold's ostentatious feet. And now Schwarzenegger was king, the proud cock of the walk. Before the Mr. Olympia contest night was over, it surfaced that he had tricked Sergio into walking off stage. Arnold himself boosted, "With all the noise going on in the auditorium, I turned to Sergio and I told him that I had enough. And if it was all right with him, we should pack it in." He agreed and he walked off, expecting me to follow. When I heard the booing, I knew Sergio had hanged himself. Nice. Arnold was making a habit of tricking the Cuban. After their encounter in Columbus, he told Sergio, "I won because I caught you on an off night. You've lost some weight. If you pack on another 10 pounds or so, by the time we meet in September, you'll be unbeatable." And like a trusting idiot, Sergio had taken Arnold at his word. No wonder he'd been so reluctant to remove the butcher's overalls in New York. 2 days after Arnold had been declared Mr. Olympia, Joe Weider and one of his favorite photographers, Jimmy Caruso, were at a Manhattan studio shooting some of the sport's leading personalities. There were winners and losers from the weekend's contest among them, Dave Draper, Franco Colombo, Chuck Colras, Schwarzenegger, and the writer. Sergio was expected, but then he had always been late for his ritual photo session. Moreover, now that his crown had been forcibly removed, most of us doubted that he would actually show up. For all we knew, Sergio was at that time crying into his breakfast cereal. By 2 p.m., the patience of most of those present had evaporated into the New York September heat. Zane had to return to Los Angeles, where he had a school teaching job. Colras wanted to resume work on a movie in Hollywood. Draper talked indecipherably about things arcane and celestial. For some time, Draper had been conferring quietly with Arnold in a corner. Suddenly, Dave announced in a loud voice that he would not remove his shirt before Caruso's camera unless Joe Weider paid him in advance for the session, and in cash. Now, it is very rarely that Joe carries cash. At first, he did not take Draper seriously. After all, the two had for years enjoyed a wonderful relationship based on mutual trust. But Dave was adamant, and Joe soon realized that he had a problem on his hands. He made yet another try at placating Draper. No use. "I don't like the vibrations coming from you," Dave screamed. "Pay me cash or I won't pose." Arnold came to the rescue with a great flourish. He asked Joe how much was needed. When Joe told him, Arnold handed over the cash. Draper's individual session done, Joe called on Arnold, Franco, Zane, Colras, and me to join Dave in a special photo that Joe wanted for an advertising campaign. When each of us was in place, Joe said, "Okay, guys, you look just right. Now flex real hard. Right. Take it, Jimmy." But no sooner had Joe issued his instructions than Arnold let out with his rib-cracking imitation of the publisher's voice. "Lock the back leg, guys." And the whole group, save for Draper and Zane, folded up laughing. Joe tried again. But once again more, Arnold came out with another gag just as Caruso was about to shoot. And once more, the picture was spoiled. This went on for another 3 attempts, during which time Draper was ready to scale the heavens before the cameraman succeeded in capturing our images the way Joe Weider wanted. It was then that Sergio Oliva deigned to make his appearance, his massive gold bracelets and necklaces clanking with every haughty step. With no apology for his lateness, the former Mr. Olympia demanded that Joe disregard those who had been waiting to be photographed all morning and attend to him. He had a plane to catch, and it would not do to have him risk missing it. For the next 20 minutes, Sergio pumped up his body in the corner of the studio. Then when he was satisfied that his muscles were sufficiently bloated and Jimmy was ready to shoot, Sergio casually announced that he would not step before the camera until he had received full payment in cash. It was the Draper scene all over again. Once more, Arnold came to the rescue. With great charm and before the hypnotized eyes of Oliva, Arnold offered Joe Weider his Olympia purse, so that Oliva's conditions might be met without further disruption of the day's shooting. There was a great relief in Joe's eyes as he accepted the money. It is anyone's guess what went on in Joe Weider's mind during that second unmerited assault on his good name. He had done much for Draper and Sergio, had made them both world famous, and when it was all said, had nurtured the good business relationship that had existed among them until that day in New York. Many times he had taken the two champions out on the town after their victories in New York, treated them to sumptuous champagne dinners, offered them opportunities for a better livelihood. Doubtless the acid of disappointment must have eaten into great portions of Joe Weider's good nature during the altercations with Oliva and Draper at the photo studio. Only time would tell if the publisher's faith in the bodybuilder's sense of fair play could ever be restored. All signs indicate that Joe's personal relationship with Draper and Oliva never returned to its original status, even though it is true that for a long time after the New York contretemps, Joe continued to work with the two champions. Ah, but how the Weider-Schwarzenegger friendship bloomed. The two visited art galleries in New York. Joe bent on developing an Arnold a taste for the more elegant life. They planned advertising campaigns together, much of that geared to enhance Arnold's bodybuilding reputation around the world. Arnold's courses were soon on the market, and under Joe's guidance, a new business-oriented butterfly began to break out of the caterpillar's cocoon. Now, here's a story dying to be related in detail. We have neither the time nor space on this occasion. It will hold, of course. In time, it would surface that the strange behavior exhibited by Sergio and Draper in New York had its roots in certain conversations that the two had had with Arnold. But that was never validated. It remains a rumor. Arnold went on to enjoy further Olympia victories, some involving more triumphs over Sergio, and he achieved fame worldwide. He appeared in some forgettable movies, and he won the Golden Globe Award regardless. And in a very short time, he developed into one of the most effective media stars in America. He fell deeper in love with the success, and his love was not unrequited. Whereas in the hearts of ordinary men pump blood through their bodies, it's the very essence of serendipity that courses through Arnold Schwarzenegger's veins. Bury him in a chemical dump, and at the end of 2 weeks, he will arise healthy, clean, beaming, with a pot of gold under each arm. But Arnold discovered that good fortune also carries its special price tag. He had promoted his first Mr. Olympia event with great success, financially at least. But there was that unforgettable issue that developed when his friend Franco found cause for complaint after winning the title in 1976. From his coign of vantage, it had seemed to Franco that Arnold took every conceivable step to guarantee victory for Frank Zane. There were the West Coast bodybuilders who had contemptuously suggested after the 76 Olympia that Arnold had pocketed thousands of dollars from the show's profits, but was most reluctant to offer reasonable purses to the winners in the contest. Bet your life Arnold's temper exploded. He issued his acerbic denunciation of Franco for having suspected hanky-panky at the Olympia, and then he declared that the complaining West Coast bodybuilders were essentially beach bums with a deep-rooted aversion for regular work. They sit around Venice Beach all day long, Arnold fumed, just waiting for people like myself to make money for them. I put my tail on the line and promote a contest, offer more money than has ever been available to Olympia winners before, but still, these fellows think I'm not entitled to a share of the profits. If they believe there's easy money to be made, then why don't they get off the sand and promote their own events? No one would stop them from taking the profits to the bank. Arnold was also careful to point out that Frank Zane, who had missed becoming Mr. Olympia by just 1 point, had expressed full satisfaction with the way the proceedings had been conducted. And Frank Zane's star shone for 3 years thereafter. He was thrice declared Mr. Olympia. On the third occasion, however, it surfaced that while Zane had kept his peace for nearly 8 years, he had not been vacationing on Mars. Obviously, he too had heard of the rumors of trickery played by Arnold on his West Coast friends. And doubtless Zane must have bristled at the realization that upon the arrival of Arnold and Franco in California, his publicity in the Weider journals had greatly diminished. Well, now that he was Mr. Olympia 3 times over, it seemed something godlike had taken root in Frank's self-confidence. Now he was standing before the CBS television cameras with the show's co-promoter and TV host for the day, Arnold Schwarzenegger, ready to do the few seconds interview that normally followed the announcement of the Mr. Olympia results. Tell me, Frank, Arnold said through the glitter of his Hollywood teeth, how does it feel to be Mr. Olympia 3 consecutive years? As if he did not know, he who had taken the biggest bodybuilding title on 6 straight occasions. Well, Frank replied, his resemblance to Dustin Hoffman more striking than ever, it feels almost as good as when I beat you for the Mr. Universe title. What a jolt to the collective consciousness of television land. For the false fact that Arnold had never been defeated in competition had long been a vital part of the Schwarzenegger legend. Much later, of course, Frank Zane would find cause to recall his reckless display of machismo in the sensitive face of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and perhaps wonder if, in fact, Arnold had chosen to compete in the 1980 Mr. Olympia only to break Zane's winning streak. Never mind that Arnold had told at least one writer that his main purpose was to teach Mike Mentzer and Boyer Coe a lesson after they reportedly tried to belittle him during their seminars around the country. On the matter of Arnold's decision to compete in Australia, Zane said, I talked with him a week before we left for Australia. I knew that he had contracted to do the commentary for ABC television. We spoke about my condition, my chances in the contest, my accident, and so on. But he never once let on that he would compete. Arnold is that way, of course. You never really know where you stand with him. When I saw him at the Mr. Olympia prejudging, I felt very angry at first, but then I began to feel sorry for him. I mean, he looked so bad. I just couldn't imagine what had tempted him to return that way. It couldn't have been the money. Arnold's assault on Mike Mentzer's sensitivity when he loudly told Mike, "We all know you lost last year's Mr. Olympia because you have a big belly," suggests that he was serious when he later told a reporter that he had decided to compete in order to teach Mentzer respect for his betters. It should be clear by now that Arnold, the competitor, is no respecter of sacred cows. Once he has donned his posing trunks, nothing is sacred. Witness the fact that when Arnold competed against the man whom he was long said was his hero, Reg Park, his behavior was no different from his treatment of Sergio Oliva. Indeed, I've often wondered whether Arnold would have defeated Sergio had he depended solely on his physique. Truth is that Arnold had sought out and discovered the chink in Sergio's armor. The Cuban was not nearly as self-confident as thousands have imagined him to be. Yes, Arnold had discovered Sergio's weak spot, a matter that had not a thing to do with his muscles, and Arnold had been relentless with his knife twisting. And his psychology had worked so effectively against the great Oliva, is it so difficult to comprehend why Arnold would not try to use the same weapon on Mentzer? When Arnold arrived with his movie crew at the Sydney Opera House, he was merely repeating a tested formula. He had appeared with a similar crew in South Africa in 1975, had been regarded as a monster superstar even before the contest began, and had experienced no great difficulty wiping out Serge Nubre, Lou Ferrigno, and Franco Colombo, the bit players in his pumping iron vehicle to stardom. The organizers and judges never should have permitted Arnold that psychological edge in South Africa, and certainly the African experience should have alerted the authorities to guard against a repetition of the circumstances in Australia. The contenders in the 1980 Olympia should have voiced their dissent in the face of Arnold's arrogance. They did not, convinced as they were that the Austrian was in such bad shape that no amount of monkey business would save him from his deserved punishment. But horror of horrors, Arnold won. The tricks that had worked so well during his years of competition had proved successful yet again. His arrogance, his rebellious behavior, his disregard for IFBB law, all of that had been allowed by contenders and judges to work in his favor. And too late, the champs were crying into their hotel pillows for having been less than vigilant. After one Mr. Olympia contest, Arnold told a writer that he was proud to call Boyer Coe a friend. He said, "Here is one of the champions that I wish other bodybuilders would try to emulate. Boyer is the personification of the true Southern gentleman." Schwarzenegger's recently reported remarks notwithstanding, there's no need for Coe to believe the Austrian has had a change of heart. Arnold has, on many occasions, expressed great respect for the champions of our sport. He knows it takes blood and guts to achieve even Mr. America status. He's volunteered much praise for the current high standard of competition all over the country. Arnold loves bodybuilding as much as he loves the good life. While bodybuilding has been particularly good to him, it's also a fact that Schwarzenegger has been wonderful for our sport. True, he could have put in a good word about the IFBB during his many TV appearances. He has not, so far. I hope this has been merely an oversight. It must be remembered that champions are aggressive tigers, not purring kittens. They can't afford to be pussycats. They live only to win. Victory carries the juice that is their lifeblood. One wonders if indeed it is possible to be loved by all the people and still win Mr. Olympia awards. Is the Mr. Nice Guy of the shows really a wonderful chap or merely a clever hypocrite? Let us now remind Arnold that he made a fool of himself even as he was on his way to becoming Mr. Olympia for a record 7th time. Goodness knows his reputation took a severe beating around the world as a result of his performance in Australia. He has had time enough to ponder the events of the last few months, and no doubt he's intelligent enough to know that he has not been altogether clever throughout. On the other hand, we owe it to ourselves to accept the fact that even Arnold Schwarzenegger is human, which is to say vulnerable, susceptible, and not without sin. The good that he's done far outweighs that indiscretion in Australia. We can and should forgive, for there are lessons to be learned from what occurred in Sydney. We can turn a page and start over again with Arnold. Never mind that he might pretend to be Oliva's replacement as God. We know his number. We can show sympathetic understanding. Bodybuilding will be bigger as a result. We will all be bigger as a result. The end. All right, guys, another classic article by the great Rick Wayne. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed part two of our interview with Rick Wayne. We will have part three of our interview next week. If you have any emails you'd like to send, you can send them to naturalolympia@gmail.com. Until then, stay safe, train hard, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.